Good morning. Great to see you all this morning, as always. Welcome to the Timberlane Church Christ. Again, if you're a guest of ours, we are just honored to have you with us this morning. Pray that you'll come back and visit us every time you can. Hope that you really do see Jesus today. Hope that you're encouraged by being here as we begin a brand new year here in Timberlane. It is a brand new year, right? Welcome to 2010. You know, it seems like only yesterday that we were all talking about and worrying about Y2K. Remember that? Remember that big hoax? I don't know if it was a hoax or not. Remember we were all worried, though, at year 2000 that computers were going to crash, banks would fail, power would be knocked out on a worldwide basis, nuclear weapons would accidentally be deployed, your VCR would flash 12 for the rest of eternity, life as we know it would grind to a halt. Right? But the year 2000 came and went, and life goes on, right? My VCR still flashes 12, but doesn't have anything to do with the date. Personally, though, I'm glad it's 2010. Because, to be real honest with you, I didn't know what to call the last decade. Was it the O's? Was it the zeros? The aughts? That's not right. I'm glad it's 2010. It really won't be till 2013 that I really feel comfortable, because then I can say we're living in the teens. Right? So we're still in a little bit of limbo. But you know the old saying that the days go slow, months go fast, and nothing really changes? That's not really true, is it? If you look back at your life in the past year, I suspect there's been some changes. If you go back 10 years, this is a brand new decade, I'll guarantee that your life has changed in the past 10 years. You're in a different place. You're in some different circumstances today than you were 10 years ago. And I know that for a lot of people, especially this time of year, it's pretty normal not just to look backwards, but to look forward, right? January 1st, the first Sunday of a year, is kind of a natural time for us to plan ahead a little bit, to look forward, to make some decisions, some resolutions, are the word we use, right? I went back and looked up the top five New Year's resolutions of 2009. And I got this off of MSN's homepage, and to be honest, I don't know if they did a bit of research or not. Some guy might have just made them up, but they make sense to me. They seem like they fit. Top five New Year's resolutions of last year. Number one, spend more time with friends and family. Everybody wants that, right? Number two was to lose weight or get fit. Number three was to quit smoking. Number four, get out of debt. Number five, to enjoy life more. Now, I guess if you get the first four figured out, number five comes naturally, right? I'll enjoy life more if I can get those others figured out. But this time of year, we start to think what's important to us, what really matters to us. And it's natural to think of who we are and what we want to be, where we are and where we want to be, and we start making decisions and some plans about what is most important to us. And obviously, what's important to you might not necessarily be important to me. I guess we've all got our agendas, personal things that are kind of important to us. A week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I received an email from Dennis Threadgill. The subject line, some of you might have got the same email, the subject line on my inbox was, "Hundreds gather to protest global warming." And I thought, do I even want to open that? Let me be honest, I don't agonize too much over global warming. If that's your thing, fine. I don't spend too much time thinking about it, but I thought I'll go ahead and open it, see what these people, one more group, I really want to read about another group who's banging the drum about global warming, but I went ahead and opened it. It contained a picture. I thought I'd share the picture with you this morning. Put that picture up, Keith. There's the hundreds who have gathered to protest global warming. And obviously, those snowmen probably are a little bit more concerned about global warming maybe than I am. It's important to them, right? But I look at that picture, and actually, as I kind of sat there at my desk and looked at it, two thoughts came to mind. First, Dennis, you got way too much time on your hands. But second, there are things that are important to us. There's some things that are important to all of us. Some things that we just feel, this is worthy of my time. This is worthy of my effort. This is worthy of my attention. This is something that really is important to me. So I ask you this morning, brand new year, brand new decade, what's important to you? This morning, what is it that's important to you? 2010, brand new year, new challenges, new opportunities. And for us here at Timberlane, a new theme as well. We have a new theme for the year 2010. You've already heard it. It's taken from the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 8. Jesus is speaking to his disciples just before he's taken back to heaven. And he tells them, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." You will be my witnesses. Another version says, "You will testify about me with great effect." Jesus told these men, "I want you to do something for me. I want you to witness. I want you to testify on my behalf. I want you to tell people my story. I want you to go and tell people my story. I want you to tell people about me." And I guess whether we use the word resolution or commitment or pledge or promise, as we think about a new year and new opportunities, we've all got things that we would like to do differently. We've all got things I suspect that we would like to do better. And really, intellectually understanding what those things are isn't the problem. If we really sit down and write out some lists of what we would like to do differently or better, we could make those lists pretty easily. That's why all those New Year's resolution lists kind of sound the same. We know what we want to do differently. We know how we want to be better. In fact, I'll go a step farther. Really, knowing how to do it's not the problem either. Intellectually, we understand what it's going to take to be who we want to be, to get where we want to be. If I'm making a resolution to lose weight, I know what it's going to take. I'm going to have to exercise more or eat less or some combination of the two. I know what it'll take. My problem isn't knowing what I want or even knowing how to achieve it. My problem is just a lack of focus. It is really hard just to stay focused on the things that I know I need to do. And by the way, I got to tell you, I'm the world's worst at staying focused. Not too long ago, Martha was working in the kitchen, and she said, "Hey, I need that pan that you borrowed." I said, "Yeah, I took it out of the shed. I'll go get it for you." So I go out to the shed to get the pan for her. 20 minutes later, she walks into the shed. I'm sitting on the floor looking at pictures. She said, "Where's that pan you were going to get for me?" "Oh, yeah, sorry. Well, the pan was sitting on the mower, and I saw the mower had a flat tire, so I thought I'd go ahead and pump the tire up." She looks at the mower with a flat tire. She says, "So why don't you pump the tire up?" "Well, the belt on the compressor is just about to break, but I got a new one, so I thought I'd just be a good time to go ahead and change the belt on the compressor." She looks at the compressor belt. It's all torn up, you know. "So why didn't you change the belt on the compressor?" "Yeah, well, the belt was in the cabinet down here. When I opened the cabinet, there's this box of lights from Maggie's wedding that should go up in the crawl space, so I thought I'd go ahead and put those up in the crawl space." "So why aren't the lights up in the crawl space?" "Well, when I got up in the crawl space, I found this box of pictures. I thought I'd sit down and look at these pictures again." "Here's your pen." It is so easy to get distracted. It is so easy to lose focus. We have all these great intentions, all these great desires, but somewhere along the line, we just get sidetracked. We lose focus. You know, when you think about it, Jesus was a man who never lost focus. He just never lost his focus. You want to talk about distractions? Well, Jesus had some distractions. You want to talk about people trying to get his attention and change his agenda and trying to, you know, get him to do things. You know, people, friend and foe, throwing things at him all the time. But Jesus just was able to keep his focus all the time. So this morning, it's the very first Sunday of a brand new year, brand new decade. Let me ask you, where's your focus? Where's your focus this morning? What's your goal? What's your plan? Do you have one? You know, we make plans all the time. We make plans in business. We want to succeed in business, so we make plans. We get more schooling. We take some classes. We go in earlier. We stay later, whatever it is, because we want to be successful. We have plans to be successful with our family relationships. You know, we make decisions that, okay, I'm going to spend more quality time with my family. I'm not going to travel as much. We're going to eat dinners together. We make plans to succeed in, you know, our physical lives. I'm going to join a gym. I'm going to try to eat a more healthy diet. On a spiritual level, where's your focus? What's your plan? What's your spiritual plan for 2010? You know, we use these church words all the time. We use words like purpose and vision and mission and commission. Can we define those words? Can we explain those things to other people, let alone live them out in our own lives? What's your plan? What's your focus? This morning, why are you here? On a spiritual level, what's your purpose for being here? It's a brand new year. Let's start at the very beginning. Why are you here? You know, if we were really honest with each other, I suspect we'd get quite a few different answers to that question. Well, I'm here because it's Sunday morning and I've come here for the last 30 or 40 years. Where else would I be on Sunday morning but here? I'm here because my parents made me come. I'm here because if I wasn't here, my spouse would make my week miserable. I'm here to keep an eye on things. Make sure you, me, don't say something stupid. I'm here for the singing. I'm here for Faith Lane. I'm here for the youth program. I'm here. Why? Why are you here this morning? What's your purpose for being here? Let me share with you some reasons why I'm here this morning, the first Sunday of 2010. And the first reason, my first purpose for being here is really pretty obvious and pretty simple, but it's a powerful motivator. At least it is for me. I'm here because I love the church. One reason I'm here is because I love the church. You know, I don't use the word precious very often, but the church is precious to me. I cherish the church. There's a book out right now written by a man named Steve McCraney. The title of the book is Love Jesus, Hate Church. And the subtitle is How to Survive Church or Die Trying. I have to admit, I haven't read that book. But I have read several reviews of the book, and the author's premise is that there's a large section of our society that really has an affection for Jesus, but for whatever reasons, they have a distrust or maybe even a disgust for church. I saw a billboard here in town that was advertising a particular church, and it said, "The church for the people who hate church." Well, that's not for me. I love church. The Lord's church is precious to me. And I'll give you a couple reasons why. I love the people in church. Now, wait a minute. The church isn't a place. It's the people. I know that. It's what I'm saying. I love the people at church. I love the fact that I am encouraged by you. I love the fact that I am accepted by you. I love the friendships that I have here, the relationships that I have here. I love the fact that you're accepted here. All of us, with all of our problems, all of our issues, all of our baggage, we come here and we feel loved. We feel like we belong here. How to survive church? I couldn't survive without church. I love church because of her influence. You know, right during one of Jesus' most famous lessons, he told his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth." I don't think I've ever gotten up from a really good meal and say, "Wow, that's some good salt. That was really good salt." I don't think I've ever said that. But I have gotten up and said, "Now those are good mashed potatoes. But they wouldn't have been very good without the salt." Jesus' point was salt has an influence on things. I love the church because of her influence. Church has an influence on me. Church has a worldwide influence. And I'm excited about the fact that Timberlane has had and is having, and I think will continue to have in even larger ways, an influence on the community around us. And I love that about the church. But let me tell you the main reason why I love the church. I love her founder. I love the person that founded the church. Matthew chapter 16, Jesus is talking with some of his very closest friends, and he asks the question, "What are people saying about me? What's kind of the word on the street out there?" And his disciples say, "Well, boy, they're saying everything about you. Some say you're John the Baptist. Some say you're Elijah or Jeremiah, one of the prophets. It's all over the board." Then Jesus asked them, "What do you say about me?" And of course, it's Peter who speaks up and says, "I say you're the Messiah. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus told Peter upon that fact, upon that confession, upon the truth that "I am the Messiah, I am the Son of God, I'll build my church. The gates of hell won't stop it." Jesus loves his church. You look through Scripture and it's just filled with instances telling us how dearly Jesus loves the church. I love the imagery that Paul uses in the book of Ephesians as he compares the church and Christ to a bride and a bridegroom. He says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless." Now, a groom loves his bride. A groom will focus on his bride's positive traits, and he'll overlook some of his bride's negative traits because he's in love with that bride. One of the very first weddings that I ever performed as a minister turned out to be one of the most memorable weddings I have ever witnessed. This young lady walked through the door. I was down front with her husband-to-be. She's walking down, the music's playing. She gets about halfway down the aisle, and she just breaks down. I mean, she just loses it. She starts bawling. I don't mean she's not whimpering. She's not like fighting back tears. She, you know, her lips not quivering. She is wailing and just boo-hooing. And I'm thinking, great. How am I going to calm this girl down? I don't know what I'm doing up here. Now, how am I going to pull this off? She gets down front, and she's a beautiful girl. Just a beautiful girl. But by the time she got down to where I was standing with her bride, her husband-to-be, she wasn't so beautiful anymore. She was a mess. Her eyes were all swollen. Her face was all red and blotchy. She had tears everywhere. She kept rubbing her eyes, and you know, makeup was smeared everywhere. And then she wiped it on her dress, and it was like, oh, no. And she is just wailing. I look over at her, the groom, and he starts crying. And actually, at that point, I'm like, I'm feeling your pain, buddy. You know, yeah, I'm with you on this one. Somehow, we got through that marriage ceremony. And when I told the groom, "You may now kiss your bride," rather than taking her veil and folding it back up over her head, He just lifted it a little and bent down and got up in there with her. Gave her a kiss and got back out. And I thought, okay, there's something you don't see every day. But that groom loved his bride. He just loved his bride. So much so that he saw past the red face and the tears and the stain on the dress. He saw her for what he knew her to be. Beautiful. Perfect. Jesus, the groom, loves the bride. And he sees us without stain, without wrinkle, without blemish. And one day, the bridegroom is going to return for the bride. Why am I here? I'm here because I love the Lord's church. I love the things that the Lord loves. Jesus founded his church on the fact that he is God's son, purchased the church with his blood. But I'm also here because I realize that I'm not going to stay here. I realize that there is more of my life than this. And when I say this, I mean my life. You know, we just sang the song, "This World Is Not My Home, I'm Just Passing Through." Boy, that's one of our standards, right? We know that song. My daughter could sing all four verses of that song when she was 2 years old. We know that song. Of course, she would sing "The Angels Peck at Me from Heaven's Open Door." And it kind of weirded her out, I think. But she pretty quickly realized what that song was saying. This isn't what we were created for. This world is not our home. We're just strangers and aliens here. We're just passing through. Our treasures are somewhere else. We were made not for this world. We were made for eternity. I'm here because I was made for eternity. Listen again to what Paul had to say in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. It's kind of our anchor text for the morning. "Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we'll have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, so that what's mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose, and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come." God has made us for this very purpose. We have been made for eternity. I'm not some cosmic accident. I'm not some compilation of molecules and tissue and bone, and one day it's going to be dead like Rover, dead all over. That's not me. I was made for eternity. Look at the person sitting beside you. Go ahead. Take a look at the person sitting beside you. Don't they look eternal? Right? I don't mean really old. I mean, don't they look eternal? God has given that person sitting beside you a soul that will never die. An eternal soul. And he's done the very same for you as well. Now, God made us for this very purpose. We have an eternal value. We're made for the purpose of focusing on things that aren't going to tear up, aren't going to burn up, aren't going to rot, aren't going to mold. We're made for focusing on things that are eternal. We're made for focusing and thinking about soul stuff, to put our hearts and our minds on things above. This world is not my home. It's not. I attended this past weekend a funeral of a dear, dear friend, one of my mentors. And it was a celebration. It was a celebration of the life that he'd lived and the victory that he'd gained. He was a man who understood this world wasn't his home. And it's not mine either. I'm going to leave here someday. In fact, I know when I'm leaving. I do. How do I know that? I looked it up online. I'm not joking. There's a website called deathclock.com that you can go to, and you can type in a little bit of information about yourself, and it will tell you when you're going to die. So I went and typed in my information. I typed in my birthday. I typed in a few questions about my outlook on life. I typed in my body mass index, and I didn't lie about it. And I found out when I hit the submit button that I will die on Wednesday, November 14th, 2046. I'll be 86 years old, which sounds pretty good, till I get to that Tuesday, I guess. I went back and changed one answer. I put originally that I had an optimistic outlook on life. I went back and changed that to I have a pessimistic outlook on life, and hit the calculate button again, and this time it said my new death date was going to be July 21st, 2014. Just by having a pessimistic outlook, I've lost 32 years. Now, what does that all mean? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But it is a little bit sobering to see a date attached to your death. You know, it's a little bit sobering to see that, and it did make me sort of stop and think about where my focus is and what's most important to me. I'm sure some of you are no doubt familiar with the name of Randy Alcorn. He's a Christian writer, does a lot of blogging. In one of his books, he made used an example that I thought was really powerful. And I wanted to share this example with you this morning. And I asked Jamie Lassiter if he would help me do this. Jamie, come on up here. Help me out for a minute. I called Jamie last night and said, "Hey, Jamie, I'm going to need some help tomorrow in my sermon. I was wondering if you'd help me out." He said, "I'll be glad to help you out. What do I have to do?" And I didn't really tell Jamie too much of what he had to do because, well, it just works better that way, right? So come on up here, Jamie. I want you to hold this up. It's just, now you're gonna think sort of that where people can see it. You'll think, okay, that's just a white piece of paper. But if you look closely, I mean, you might not all be able to see it. There's a dot in the middle of that white piece of paper. That dot represents Jamie's life. The whole thing. Beginning, middle, and end. And you say, wow, that's kind of harsh, isn't it? I mean, my whole life just reduced to nothing but a dot, you know, beginning, middle, boom, end, that's it. Second part to this illustration. I'll take that and I'll give you this. Very good, yeah, that. Walk about halfway back there. This line, this working its way up between Don Covan's legs, this line is going to represent Jamie's eternity. And obviously, I don't have enough line to make it work. But this is what's important. In fact, just go all the way to the back, Jamie. Just go all the way to the back door back there. And we'll try to keep it as tight as we can. And, you know, I wish I had more line. But the dot is his life. The line is eternity. In fact, I'll tell you what, Jamie, just prop that door open. Go on back into the lobby. Yeah, just don't worry about disturbing the people in the lobby. They're not supposed to be there. So just go on out to the lobby. Very good. Yeah, there you go. In fact, go all the way back to the table back there. There you go. What? Couch. Okay, good. Very good. Okay, you're so close. Go on to the front door. There you go. Good job. We'll keep it nice and tight. This is eternal line. In fact, hey, Jamie, just go out into the parking lot. Walk down Timberlane School Road. When you get to I-10, go west. No, I'm kidding. Come on back. You know, Jamie's the kind of guy, if I tell him to go, he goes. Right? He's headed to Pensacola out there. But I want you to think about something. This is what matters. It's not the dot. it's the line. And every morning when I wake up, I need to make a decision to live my life for the line, not for the dot. Say that with me. Live for the line, not for the dot. Live for the line, not for the dot. See, dot thinking is so easy to get tied up in. It's so easy to get tied up in this dot thinking. It's short-term thinking. It's very short-sighted. It is right here, right now thinking. Dot thinking involves taking care of all those things that everyone's asking me to do, all those things that are always being piled on my plate, all those decisions I've got to make, all those places I've got to go, all those things I've got to do, and I've got to get the kids here, and I've got to be in this group meeting, and I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and all I'm really able to do is keep my head above water, and I go to bed, and I'm just exhausted, and the next morning I wake up, and I'm right back on the same treadmill. I don't feel like I get anything accomplished because I'm just focused on the dot. But the line is all that really matters. When I get up in the morning, I need to decide, what am I going to do and how am I going to live my life focused on the line, focused on eternity? And it's actually a really practical application. You know, when you think about it, you think about you're dealing with your children. And your son or your daughter comes to you and they say, okay, Dad, I want to do this. I want to go with my friends and go here and do this. And all right away, you know, bells go off in your mind. You know, that's, everything about my best judgment says that's going to be a mistake. And that's not a good place to go. And it's not a good thing to be involved in. But if you're focused on the dot, dot thinking says, you know what, if it'll make you happy, go ahead. If you're focused on the dot, you're saying, you know what? If it'll keep us from having one more argument, go ahead, because I'm just not up for the fight. If you're focused on the dot, you're saying it's just going to be easier to get you out of the house for a couple hours, then go ahead. But let me warn you something, parents. If you spend all your time with your kids focused on the dot, they'll never see the line. They'll never get it. They'll never see it. Or in your business, you know, you go to work, you say, you know, I could cut a few corners. I could take advantage of a situation. I could take advantage of some people, and I could better myself. Maybe it's not the ethical thing to do, but come on, everybody does it. That is dot thinking. That is not line thinking. See, one of Satan's greatest strategies is to get us to focus on the dot. If he can just keep us focused on the right here, right now, and nothing else, then he is ahead of his game. If he can just get us to put that line thinking off until we're a little bit older, or a little bit more mature, or we've kind of got our lives figured out a little better, then we'll get serious about this, then Satan smiles. But every day we've got all these decisions to make. You know, you decide, what am I going to do this weekend? Are you going to focus on the dot? Or are you going to focus on the line? You have a conversation with your wife, with your children. Are you going to talk about the dot? Or are you going to talk about the line? Let me wrap up by bringing your attention back to Jamie's line. Jamie's eternity. You know, Jamie is a great guy, young guy, just a ton of talent. The whole world's before him. He's going to have just thousands of options in his life. And it's going to be exciting to see where Jamie is 10 years from now. But when you're talking about Jamie's line, there's only two options. And I think you know what I'm talking about. One of his line options is a place that is so wonderful that he can't begin to imagine it. And it will last longer than he can imagine. His other line option is a literal place that we call hell, where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth, and it will last longer than he can imagine. And you know what? We have the same two options. You're going to focus on the dot, for 2010, are you going to focus on the line? We're told to set our hearts and our minds on things above. Think about spiritual things. We were created for spiritual things. This world is not our home. We're just passing through. First Sunday of a brand new year, brand new decade. What better time to fall more deeply in love with the things that Jesus loves, to hate the things that Jesus hates, and make the decision, I'm going to set my heart and my mind on things above, on line things, on eternal things.